My brain and my computer are both on 1/4 capacity.
Okay, we will, first of all, a good news on that. And we are broadcasting from an undisclosed location in Yerushalayim. And
while we wait for the building to be finished.
Right, okay. Those of you who want to contribute to our building fund will... now, I think we have to commence with chapter 14 in the second section of the guide, the Moreh Nevuchim. And here the Rambam is going to begin his refutation of the theories of the eternity of the universe. The main refutation will be against that of Aristotle, but we'll see that he was also going to, in a certain sense, raise questions with respect to Plato's too. In any case, the Rambam begins chapter 14. I guess I'll read it from the Pinnis's translation. He says, this is on the Pinnis translation, page 285, in the Schwartz edition, which I'm also following somehow, that's page 301. So he says, I do not need to repeat in every chapter that I compiled this treatise for your benefit, only because of my knowledge of your achievements. I do not need to set forth in every passage the text of the discourse of the philosophers, but only their intentions. I shall not write at length, but only draw your attention to the methods that they aim at, as I did for you, regarding the opinions of the Mitu Kalimum, this is the Kalam. I shall pay no attention to anyone who besides Aristotle is engaged in speculative discourse, for it is his opinions that ought to be considered. And if there are good grounds for refuting him or raising doubt with regard to these opinions as to some point on which you make a refutation or raise doubts, these grounds will be even firmer and stronger with respect to all the others who disagree with the fundamental principles of the law. Okay, first of all, before we continue, this paragraph is important because it's really from the very few times in the Moreh Nevuchim itself that he makes reference to the person to whom he's writing the Moreh Nevuchim. Now, who is he speaking to? So he's speaking to the Moreh Nevuchim at the very, very beginning. He has what's called the Igeras, it's translated Igeras al Talmud, which is a letter to a student. He's speaking to his student Yosef, who, as you know, is studied mathematics, astronomy, and logic with the Rambam, and then he was forced to leave or interrupt his study to go after his father's death in order to take care of the family business. And the Moreh Nevuchim is being written as a response to Joseph's letter, in which he has several questions in religion and theology, and he is interested in the ways of who are called the Medablin, the Metukalin, which means the Kalam. And the entire Moreh Nevuchim, at least certainly from the standpoint of the Igeres of the letter, is being written to dissuade Yosef from following the theology of the Kalam, but rather he has to understand the Chumash or the issues in terms of Aristotelian philosophy. So in other words, basically the Moreh Nevuchim from the standpoint of this first letter, this epistle to his son Joseph, to his Talmud, the student Joseph, is basically coming that he should not become intellectually kidnapped by the Kalam. So in other words, now what's interesting is though, is that, and that's what the Rambam says. The Rambam says, I'm reading from the Schwartz tradition, I'm just going to tell you general what the philosophers mean, what the philosophers intend, just like I did with the Medablim, the Dukalim. Now, what did the Rambam do that with the Dukalim? So there's a chapter 73 in the first section, which we didn't do. And then in the chapter 73, the Rambam basically blasts the Metukalim. He just blasts them. He refutes them completely. I mean, he trashes them, and he rejects completely all of the physical and metaphysical theories of the Metukalim. And he says that I'm going to only speak in general, just like I spoke, when I spoke about the Medab column, I only spoke in general terms. So also too, I mean, I only referred, you know, I didn't actually quote the text of the Mutu column. I sort of like, you know, raise their view, their points of view in general terms. So too with the philosophers. Now, it's rather interesting is that based upon this, he says, Yadati es hasekha, I know your achievements, and I have to bring you the actual language, right, of the philosophers in every place, and you have to bring generally what they say, which means that the Rambam assumes that Yosef knows the philosophers. Now, in the Igeris itself, it's not clear that Yosef knows the philosophers. I mean, all the Rambam tells us in the Igeris, in the letter, all the Rambam tells us there is that Yosef learned with him mathematics, astronomy, and was in the middle of learning logic. Doesn't say he learned anything about the philosophers. In fact, Yosef asked him about the Mutu Kolam, right? It appears that Yosef didn't learn, because in the Pesicha, the introduction of the Rambam, Rambam says very clearly that the order of study is mathematics, astronomy, logic, and then in the Pesicha he adds physics and then metaphysics. Now, is that clear how versed Yosef was in physics? When Rambam speaks about philosophy, I assume he's speaking about physics, because the arguments he brings from Aristotle are all contained in Aristotle's physics. However, so in other words, speaking to Yosef, he says, you already know the arguments of the philosophers, meaning the physics of the philosophers. I don't have to really go into detail, I just have to sort of summarize them. But it's not clear at all in the epistle that Yosef ever learned philosophy, right? He was asking about the Kalam, maybe he had studied the Kalam, but philosophy of the Rambam certainly did not seem to express any certainty as to whether Yosef had studied physics. On the contrary, it seemed to be evident that the Rambam was supposed to teach Yosef physics. As Strauss points out, there's nowhere in the Myrna Vulcan where anyone has taught any physics. But in any case, in the Psicha, in the introduction, we also noted, I think we noted in the first class, that there's two things. There's the Geras and the Psicha. There's a letter, and then there's an introduction. In the introduction, the Rambam says that what's the purpose of this book? The purpose of this book is Lahar Adam, to enlighten the person who is religious. Asher nikba benafshoi vahuska b'munosoi amisus terasenum. I'm on now page 10 of the Schwartz edition. I'm not reading from the Strauss edition because I have the wrong volume here. But in any case, that basically he's convinced of the Torah. The Rambam is I'm only teaching a person convinced of the Torah. He's perfect both in his religiosity and in his midas, right? For Ian b'mata philosophim, and he's learned the sciences of the philosophers. V'yoda es mashmul sayim, and he understands them. V'aseichal noishim erschol avilas etla b'koymai, and respects human intellect. So he has all his problems with the Torah. In other words, the Torah seems to contradict rationalism, and therefore the person has all these. The person basically is caught in a crisis, whether to follow the Torah and to convince himself that it's not good to be rational, or to be rational, and somehow he'll have to convince himself the Torah will have to, you know, somehow make, you know, accept something which he suspects is not true. So, in other words, the Rambam, in fact, and now, the Rambam is not speaking here in the introduction to Yosef. He's not speaking in the introduction to Yosef. Have we discussed this? Why is there an Igeris? Why is there a Pesicha? That's a question that's always asked. Why is there a letter? Why is there an introduction? I just understand there was actually a political thing involved here. The letter is basically to say this is only for Kivuv. So if the Kanoim shouldn't attack him. The Pesicha, the introduction of the Rambam, actually, as you go on an introduction, it comes out that the introduction actually explains that actually that the Myrna Vulcan is actually a lachatchila, a priori type of limud that you would never get from the Igeris, but you get from the Psicha. But the fact is, either the Rambam secretly told Yosef to go learn Aristotelian physics, and then between the Igeris and the Psicha, the Rambam writes the Psicha. So the Rambam assumed that Yosef had gone back and learned physics, and the Rambam says, now I know that you know physics. As the Rambam says, I know of your achievements. What does it mean, I know of your achievements? So in other words, not only did you study with me mathematics, astronomy, and logic, and I saw that you were what you call the Yeshiva Balkishrin, that you were very talented and very intelligent, but not only that, says the Rambam, this I'm making this all up, but in other words, this is hypothesis, but basically the Rambam sent them back to learn physics, and now I know about your achievements. You've learned, you know, by yourself philosophy, physics and philosophy, and now I can address these issues as I stated I would address these issues to the audience, which I assume knows philosophy. That's one possibility. Or you could say that the Rambam is speaking in general, that the Rambam is saying is that he assumes his audience knows physics. The fact is that why does the Rambam actually go back and speak on a second person, personal level? But anyway, in any case, this is an interesting matter where the Rambam has to speak on this personal level. Now, the Rambam says that if we're going to refute or raise doubts, then it's worth it to raise doubts in Aristotelian physics. And the Rambam says that if we refute or raise doubts in Aristotelian physics, then kal v'chomer, how much more so will these doubts and, you know, these doubts and refutations hold for others who argue upon the main beliefs of the Torah. Now, on the bottom here in the Schwartz edition, he just assumes that the Rambam is speaking like a normal Aristotelian who basically looks at all other systems of philosophy and physics with much disdain. You know, as if a person today would, you know, would be a scientist and look at things like intelligent design or all different types of mysticisms that pass for science. But the fact is, it could possibly be that the Rambam could have understood actually one of two things. He could have understood that really Aristotle's arguments for the eternity of the universe were the strongest. In other words, because, he's going to bring several proofs of Aristotle. So in other words, a person could raise doubts with regard to the arguments of Aristotle, so certainly, moreover, can he raise doubts other scientific theories. A second thing could possibly be, right, is that what the Rambam is alluding to is what he writes in section 2, chapter 25. The Rambam says explicitly that one could believe in the Platonic theory of the eternity of the world, and still be called a believing Jew. So really, according to the Rambam, in a certain sense, the only doubt that has to be raised is a doubt regarding Aristotelian eternity of the universe. So what the Rambam says, I'm going to raise it regard to Aristotle, what the Rambam is really alluding to the fact is that I don't have to really refute or raise doubt as to the Platonic theory of the eternity of the universe, because that's kosher. So, in other words, what the Rambam is really saying over here is that basically he's alluding to the fact that the only menace or the only theory of eternity of the world which threatens, you know, authentic Jewish belief is Aristotle. So he's going to raise doubts regarding Aristotle. Respect to Plato, he doesn't have to. That's one second reading of the Rambam. And I thought maybe a third reading of the Rambam is that it's very interesting, is that the Rambam says two things. The Rambam says, if there's a point to be mafrich, to refute, I'm using a reading from the Schwartz edition, or la'oilas sfeikas, to raise doubts. Now, the fact is that, I'm telling you right now, we'll see this in Yitzhak Shem in a few weeks, the Rambam never refutes anything. He just raises doubts. And just to prove it to you, if we turn to chapter 25 in the Magen Avuchim, the Rambam, you know, says that if in fact the eternity of the world was proven, then we, you know, but it hasn't been proven. Therefore, I'm choosing not to take the position of the eternity of the world. Now, the fact is that if the Rambam has totally rationally refuted the eternity of the world, how is there any possibility for the eternal world to be proven? So even though the Rambam says, if there's a place to refute or to raise doubts, the Rambam is, I think, being a little political here. Really, all the Rambam intends to do is to raise doubts. That's all he intends to do. So it could possibly be that, in other words, when the Rambam uses lahafich, either he's using that as a smoke screen, right, because he wants to get the reader excited, or basically the reader to, you know, to think that he's going to refute them, and he doesn't refute them. Or, in fact, maybe lahafich was referring to other theories which he's going to refute, like the kalam which he feels is refuted. But with respect to the theory of the world, he's only raised doubts. Okay, so in other words, these are different ways of interpreting what the Rambam is saying. Like I said, you know, there's no really knowing what the Rambam intended, but there's no question about it. The language, you know, says out Darshani. Okay, fine. Okay, now that now what I want to do is I want to go to the Rambam. Now, the Rambam is going to bring several proofs of Aristotle. Altogether, the proofs of Aristotle are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 proofs of Aristotle, of the eternity of the world. Now, I have, has this been, okay, in Yitz Hashem, we're going to, I guess we'll send this off. The Rambam, at least at the beginning, is going to base himself on what is found in Book 8 of the Physics of Aristotle. And there's some, I think this this is Book 8, this is actually a Xerox of Book 8. And I think this is a famous translation, English translation of Aristotle. I think the translation of this, of this Book 8 is, who translated it? How can I have a translation? In any case, this is a, this is the standard English translation, which looks very impressive, which I found in the Hebrew University Library. And actually, it's worth it to actually go through the entire Book 8. Book 8 begins on page 418 and ends on page 446. Okay, 446. Now, reading Aristotle is not so easy. It's actually like reading Greek. There's actually someone in the university who's actually offered to teach me Greek, or to read with me in Greek. But in any case, I think what we're going to do is I'm going to read the Rambam. The Rambam doesn't really quote Aristotle. Okay? In fact, what the Rambam does is what he says he's going to do. He's basically going to just impart the basic ideas of Aristotle. He's not going to go into detail. Now, what does that mean? What does that mean? Well, the Rambam declares he's going to impart the general ideas and he's not going to go into detail. What does that mean? It can be one of two things. It can either mean that, you know, he doesn't have the time, you know, to quote Aristotle and to go through him in detail. That would probably take a lot more than the Mori Nevuchim escape, you know. That would make the Mori Nevuchim a considerably larger work. Or does it really mean what the Rambam is doing is the Rambam is picking out or what he interprets to be Aristotle's proof? I'm a little suspicious that the second interpretation, which I'm offering, is actually the true intention of the Rambam. Namely, that the Rambam, in fact, actually is going to pick out what he feels to be Aristotle's main arguments. And what we're going to do is we're going to actually read the Rambam, and then we're going to look at Aristotle and see, in fact, does this really reflect, or does this really mirror Aristotle's actual argument? I have to say that it took me a long time to find these arguments in Aristotle. Schwartz's notes at the bottom didn't help me there very much. And we'll speak about that, okay? Okay, fine, very good. Okay, now, I'm going to read it first in English. And then we'll read it in the Hebrew. First, let me first read it. Okay. So basically, this is called, this is the first proof. And then it goes through the other mitzvahs, but let's read this. Let's pick up on the first paragraph here. This is in the Schwartz edition. It's the first paragraph on page 302. And in the Pinnis edition, it's page 286. So I'm just going to read from the Pinnis edition. I say then that Aristotle asserts that motion is not subject to generation and passing away. He means motion in the absolute sense. What does he mean? That means all of motion. For he says that if a motion is produced in time, it should be considered that everything that's produced in time is preceded by a certain motion. Namely, that consisting in its passage to actuality as being produced after it had been non-existent. Consequently, a motion exists, namely the motion by means of which the latter motion was brought into being. In other words, there's a motion that caused the motion. In other words, what he's saying over here is that if you produce a motion in time, there has to be some other motion that produces the second motion. Consequently, the first motion must of necessity be eternal, or else the series will go on to finish. So says the Arab more like this. Now, what about the first motion that produced the second motion? Either that's eternal, or that began at a certain time, in which case what? There's a third motion that produced the second motion, which produced the first motion. Chad Gadya. Right? We just sang that last week. But, 2 weeks ago. But, So you have two possibilities. Either the initial motion is eternal, or there's an infinite amount of motions. Right? We're going to infinity. Likewise, conforming to this principle, he asserts furthermore that time is not subject to generation and passing away. Okay, so now, up till now, Atkan, the Rambam speaking about motion. But now he goes to time. It's interesting, why does he go to time? Stick with motion. You've already told me the motion's eternal. Right? Why do I need time? Zman lamali. So, but the Rambam says no. Likewise, in conformity with this principle, when he says likewise here, the translation likewise, look at the Shwatasi, right? He asserts furthermore that time is not subject to generation and passing away. For time is consequent upon attached to motion, and there is no motion except in time. And again, time must be intellectually conceived to accept your motion as has been demonstrated. It'll look like this. Since time is dependent upon motion, and motion must either be eternal or infinite, so therefore, because of this, right, time must be infinite too. Because time is totally on motion. There's no time without motion. This is a method of his by means of which the eternity of the world doesn't be inferred. So this proves the eternity of the world. Now, if I just look at the Rambam, it's interesting, the Rambam first, what does the Rambam do? First he proves that motion must be eternal. If motion's eternal, right, then what? Then time must be eternal. Now, the question is, I mean, the base of the question is, why do I have to say that time, why do I have to go to the second and say time is eternal? It's not to say motion's eternal. Why need time to be eternal? That's the question. I mean, the eternity of the world can be established, right, either through time, either through motion. Why do I have to raise time? Okay, we'll get to that a little bit later. Now, the question is, where is this in the physics? Now, Professor Schwartz, by the way, Derek Adam, someone told me, maybe Chalam Mayit, that Professor Schwartz became from while translating the Mara Nevuchim. We had to mafals on that. Okay, fine. Now, what'd you say? Anyway, I was about to say that. Okay, whatever it is. Well, it's Tzarech, because, so you see that the Baruch can make, like, at least one guy from. Okay, now, where does the opposite? So Professor Schwartz refers you to physics, book 8, Chapter 1. Okay? Now, if you look at Book 8, Chapter 1, the Rambam goes on and on, Aristotle goes on and on and on, but it's not clear anywhere where he makes this argument. Right? He does begin Book 8 by saying, I'm on page 418, there's actually numbers to the lines. Okay, like that. 1. Was there ever a motion before which had no being, and is it perishing again so as to leave nothing in motion? Or to say that it never had any becoming and is not perishing, but always was and always will be? Is it in fact an immortal, never failing property of things that are a sort of life as it were to all naturally constituted things? Now, for example, the Rambam introduces Bokeh by saying was motion eternal. He's not speaking about time. Now, what's interesting is that even though the Rambam, Aristotle, for example, in Aristotle on page 419, on line 18, he does speak about, now if there was an ever becoming of every movable thing, it follows that before the motion in question, another change of motion must have taken place in which there was capable of being moved or causing motion had to becoming. But the Aristotle never goes through this real, at least in chapter 1, Aristotle never goes through this entire argument. The only thing I saw over here, which actually, what Professor Schwartz lists, he just says Book A, Chapter 1, but in parentheses, on page 420, there's a section here with parentheses. Now, I'm not sure why they're parentheses. I think I have to go back to university and check out the book. What was the practical point of things in parentheses? But in parentheses, he speaks about time. In parentheses. I'll read this. Further, how can there be any before and after existence of time? Well, how can there be any time without the existence of motion? If then time is a number of motion, or itself a kind of motion, it follows that if there is always time, motion must always be eternal. But so far as time is concerned, we see that all with one exception, are agreement in saying that it is uncreated. In fact, it is just this that enables Democritus to show that all things cannot have had a becoming. For time, he says, is uncreated. Plato alone asserts the creation of time, saying that it is simultaneous with the world, and the world came into being. Interesting. Now, since time cannot exist, it is unthinkable apart from the now, and the now is a kind of middle point, uniting as it does in itself both the beginning and end, the beginning of future time and the end of past time, it's felt there must always be time. For the extremity of the last period of time that we take must be found in some now, since in time we can take nothing but nows. Therefore, since the now is both the beginning and an end, there must also be time on both sides of it. But if this is a true of time, it is evident that it must be true of motion, time being a kind of emotion. What's the Rambam going here? He's going from time to motion. The Rambam is making an example. Aristotle. This is not a slip. Aristotle is making an argument that why is motion eternal? Because time must be eternal. Now, why is time eternal? By definition. Because if I say that there was a certain time that the world began, so by definition, every point of time is defined by its past and its future. By the way, Kreskas, in his Perush on the Meir Devuchim, Perek Lamed, says that this is the proof, or this is the Bria Yesh Miayin of the Rambam. But whatever is like this. Says, in other words, everybody believes, says Aristotle, that time didn't have a beginning. Why? By the definition of time. Because a present moment of time has no real existence. You define the present moment of time by either the past or what? Or the future. So if to say that the world was created at a certain time, that implies that what? There was a previous point of time. And therefore, by definition, time could have a beginning. Now you can't have time without motion. So if time is eternal, motion's eternal. Pella Otsum. Now, this argument is in parentheses. This is the only argument that the Rambam, that Aristotle makes with respect to, you can go through all of chapter 1. This is the only argument that Aristotle makes in chapter 1. And here the argument is being made from time to motion. That's very, very interesting. Now, the Professor Schwartz, Chas v'Shalom, is not an idiot. Why is he not an idiot? Because in the Rambam, in chapter 15, the Rambam says, I'll prove to you that Aristotle didn't really have a proof of the eternity of the world. What was the proof? His proof was because he's saying, like, everybody's, like, everybody agrees to this. In other words, the Rambam says, right? And the Rambam says, what led me to believe, speak of this, the fact that the lady follows Aristotle's journey to turn the world. Most of the people who believe themselves to philosophize follow Aristotle as an authority of the question. But says the Rambam, right? That if Aristotle had proven that the world's eternal, he says this now, this is chapter 15, section 2, 290 in Pinnis, says the Rambam, if Aristotle felt that he had proved that the world was eternal, was he have to quote all the other philosophers? All of his preceding us believe the Moshe is not subject to generation, except Plato, who believes the Moshe is subject to generation. So says the Rambam. Now, it is, right? In other words, why would the Rambam have to quote different opinions? Why would Aristotle quote different opinions? Let Aristotle just what? Prove it. So the Rambam says this is a raya that Aristotle didn't prove it. Now, the fact is, where does Aristotle say this? He says this in 420 in the parentheses. That's the place where he quotes people. And the people he's quoting is speaking about time. So Professor Schwartz is right in a reading of the Rambam, that the Rambam is coming from what? From chapter 1 in book 8 of the Physics, page 420, from lines 11 to line 28. But the fact is that that's not the proof. That's not the proof. Aristotle is arguing from time to motion. And the Rambam presents the proof from motion to time. Pella atzo. Now I know why the Rambam said to his Talmud Yosef, I'm only going to summarize the arguments, not going into detail. Because if in fact actually went into detail, then you'd actually see the argument is actually, as you would say in the yeshivas, pumfakelt. Exactly the opposite. Pella atzo. Now, what's interesting is that he does make this argument. Aristotle does make this argument. But where does he make it? He makes it somewhere else. Where does he make it? Rabbi Sadler, how much were we holding time-wise? David? Okay. We're holding time-wise?
27 minutes.
Okay, fine, very good. Okay, very good.
32, meaning 27 upside down.
No, okay. But how much? 32 already. 29. We have another 30 minutes to go?
No, not
yet. Okay, fine, good. Now, actually, the Rambam, Aristotle does make this argument. I found it on page 428. This was not easy reading all of book 8. On page 428 of the Physics, on line 22, there, in a large paragraph, which is not blocked off by parentheses, Aristotle says the following thing. Aristotle says, this same argument may also be stated in another way as follows. Every mover moves something and moves it with something, either with itself or with something else. E.g., for example, a man moves a thing either by himself or with a stick, and a thing is knocked down either by the wind itself or by a stone propelled by the wind. But it is impossible for that with which a thing is moved to move it without being moved by that which imparts motion by its own agency. But if a thing imparts motion by its own agency, it is necessary that there should be anything else with that it imparts motion. Whereas if there is a different thing with which it imparts motion, there must be something that imparts motion not with something else, but with itself, or else there will be an infinite series. Well, this is the argument. If then anything is a mover, while being itself moved, the series must stop somewhere and not be infinite. Thus, if the stick moves something in virtue of being moved by the hand moves the stick. And if something else moves the hand is also moved by something different from itself. So when motion by means of an instrument is at each stage called by something different from that instrument, there must always be preceded by something else which imparts motion with itself. Therefore, if this is moving and there is nothing else that moves it, it must move itself. So this reasoning also shows that when a thing is moved, if it is not moved immediately by something that moves itself, The series brings us at some time or other to a mover of this kind. No, but my mind is saying is, either motion, it's either an eternal motion, right? Or it's going to be infinite. Which means, since of course you can't have an infinite number of things, so it must be that what? It must be that there's some mover who's not moved by something else, which of course the Aristotle's going to go on and explain that this has to be something which is incorporeal. But in other words, it seems to me that this paragraph is the closest thing to the argument that, in other words, that unless something's moved by itself, then you're going to have unless motion's eternal at one point in the chain, you're going to have something which imparts motion to it, which means you're going to end up with something infinite. So, but what's interesting is that Aristotle is not really interested in time. If you go through the entire thing, he's not really interested in time. And finally, at the very, very end of Book 8, I'm skipping quite a few pages here, but at the very, very end of Book 8, which I think ends in chapter, in, all right, and page 444, at the very end of chapter 9, on line 6, he summarizes, we have argued that there always was motion, always will be motion, throughout all time. We've explained that this is the first principle of this external motion. We've explained further that which is the primary motion and which is the only motion that can be eternal, and we pronounce the first movement to be unmoved. That's a Kodesh Baruch Hu. We also Kodesh Baruch Hu. Vika Malchamoves. Chagadya. In other words, this is actually Aristotle. You know what? Aristotle proves that since you cannot have an infinite number of causes by definition, there can't be infinity in the number of motions, so therefore one motion must be unmoved, and that has to be the first mover, who can't be corporeal, because anything which is physical has to, its motion has to be proved, produced by something else, has to be eternal. So, in other words, we get here the Maimonides, the Rambam's presentation, the proof of Aristotle, is very, very strange. Aristotle B'chlav was not really interested in time. And the only time he brought time was to just use time as a heck of tensor to prove that since there can't be beginning of time, there can't be beginning of motion, because time is contingent upon motion. But Aristotle wasn't interested at all in time, he was interested in motion. So why does the Maimonides create, not ex nihilo, but create a whole new argument in which he proves that since motion must begin, cannot begin, has to be eternal, so must be the time, has to be eternal. That's the question which rises for the intelligent and informed reader of the Meir Nevuchim. What's the Rambam doing? Now, what's interesting is that there are no easy answers to this question, as most questions here. But what's interesting to know is that the Rambam did spend, when the Rambam discussed creation ex nihilo, which he discussed on page in chapter 13, which we already covered, on page 298, the Rambam did devote a lot of time to the fact that creation ex nihilo, it means the creation of time. In other words, for the Rambam it was clear that the main point, the novella of creation ex nihilo, is that there's a beginning to time. The beginning of time. That's clear in the Rambam. The Rambam devotes a lot of time to this. But it could possibly be because maybe the beginning of time is something which is, in other words, according to the Rambam, the main point of creation ex nihilo, the central part of the philosophy of creation ex nihilo is that there's a beginning of time. The Rambam says we have to think about it. It's not very, very difficult to conceive. Which means is that if the central point of creation ex nihilo is that there's a beginning of time, so That would explain why the Rambam is, in fact, taking the methods of Aristotle and translating them into a proof for a begin for that, that time is eternal. Right? Which is rather interesting. In other words, the Rambam could have basically, you know, on the contrary, in other words, for Aristotle, there's no concept of time for Aristotle. Time is really a property of motion. For Aristotle, the basic fact of existence, the ontological basis of existence, of the physical world, is motion, not time. Time is a property of motion. There's no time other than motion. So really, right, why does the Rambam spend so much on the beginning of time? Really, time is only a property of motion. Time is not a separate, independent variable. It's a function of motion. So really, you could raise the question is, I mean, why did the Rambam spend so much time speaking about that creation is the beginning of time? Who cares about time? Who cares about time? Time is only a property of motion. So creation doesn't have to be that. Creation doesn't have to be what? Does have to be such a difficult thing that Rambam has had to think about it for such a long time? It's getting emotion. It's just like every person can imagine a thing not moving. That's creation ex nihilo. And then, but it's clear to me, this is my theory, it's clear to me that the Rambam understood that the crux of the notion of creation ex nihilo was not the fact that there is a beginning to motion, but there's a beginning of time. That seems to be the chiddush of the Rambam. It's the beginning of time. So when the Rambam presents the Aristotelian theory, proof, right, the tachlis, the purpose is to what? The purpose is to arrive at a proof that time is eternal. Now, the fact is like this. The fact is, why couldn't the Rambam just quote the proof in parentheses that time is eternal? What can prove that? Either the Rambam didn't have these parentheses in front of him. That's why we have to check his parentheses. He didn't have the parentheses in front of him, and the Rambam basically made this up. But it's hard to say, because the Rambam does quote later on in chapter 15 that, you know, the Plato, he speaks about the Plato theory of time. Either you have to say that what the Rambam is doing is the Rambam basically, you have to say the following thing. This is going to sound dangerous. That, you know, when you learn, many times, you know, let's say you learn a blot gemara. You have a Rashi and a Taisvus. Taisvus is a kasha and Rashi. Many times, Taisvus will quote the Rashi, but Taisvus doesn't exactly quote the Rashi exactly the way the Rashi says. And after you say, after Taisvus then is mafrich Rashi, and then Taisvus, what Taisvus does is they offer their own pshat to the sugya. Then you go back in Rashi and say, what are you talking about? And if you look in Rashi, it can be Yashu, Taisvus kashas. But the fact is that when Taisvus presents the Rashi, they're presenting the Rashi the way they see the Rashi. And many times my interpretation of something will be somehow user-friendly, in the sense that I interpret Rashi such a way to be mafrich Rashi. I'm not saying that Chas v'Shalom anyone is, you know, biased, but usually when you take someone, you'll present them in a way which if you want to refute that person, you'll interpret him and present him in a way which is much easily refutable. It's refutation-friendly. I want to say the same thing here, too, in the Rambam.
What I want to say
in the Rambam is that what the Rambam wants to do is, I think the Rambam held, right? I think the Rambam held that the Ikach Kiddush of creation ex nihilo is at the beginning of time. Why? Because like this. See, if time is a property of motion, then there's a head-on collision between Aristotle and Moshe Rabbeinu. either things were at one time in rest, or they're always moving. In terms of this proof of eternity of motion. Now, I've already stated what my point of view is. My point of view is that Maimonides, Rambam actually held that there's no machlokes. There's no machlokes. Why is there no machlokes? Because basically creation ex nihilo is not a physical theory of creation. In order for the Rambam to prove that or achieve that, see, according to Aristotle, there's only a world. There's nothing but the world. In order for the Rambam to do that, the Rambam had to take time and abstract it from the world. In other words, so long as time is a property of motion, they're competing theories. If I take time and make it to a thing separate from motion, right? Which is really what Newton did in the 16th century, 17th century. They make time separate from motion. That was the big breakthrough of Newton. Then already, they're not competing theories. So, what the Rambam did is took Aristotle's argument and turned them upside down. Namely, what? That really the Chiddush of creation ex nihilo is what? The beginning of time. Which, by the way, says the Rambam, you can't understand. And really, what was Aristotle trying to do? He was trying to prove that time is eternal. He was trying to prove that time was eternal. And why was he trying to prove time was eternal, right? From a proof of motion. And the Rambam, right? The Rambam Lemaisa might say that no, your proof that motion is eternal doesn't really prove. In other words, doesn't prove that time's eternal. In other words, what the Rambam is doing is, the Rambam is already defining, in other words, the Rambam is already presenting, in my opinion, a different theory of time from the very beginning. That's what I think. So in other words, what the Rambam is saying is that Aristotle and I have different hashkafas. Aristotle sees time is in the world. It's nothing but the world. But I see time as being something separate from the world. So because of that, right, there's two ways of looking at the world. You can look at the world, at the physical world, and you look at a world which is more spiritual, time in and of itself. And because of that, the two theories are not competing. You have trade in them, right? And that's overall going to be the Rambam's basic plan of saying, the way I'm going to interpret it, is that creation ex nihilo, the way Moshe Rabbeinu understood it, and Aristotle are two separate things. That's what I want to say. In which case, the Rambam, in a certain sense, is postulating a notion of time which is not like Aristotle, which might be more like Newton. I don't want to say the Rambam was a few hundred years before Newton, but the Rambam is postulating a different concept of time. That's what I want to say. Oh, yeah. You want to say? Can I say it again?
What? No, I hear.
Yeah.
Mashal is only that Lamaiso.
Yeah.
Aristotle Mineu Bey would agree that mathematically, if I demonstrate the idea of the first cause, the first mover, that I'm also speaking about a construct of an infinity of time. Aristotle would agree to that as a statement.
No, but time for Aristotle is only a property of the eternality
right,
of motion.
That's the reason.
Yeah, no, for Aristotle, there's no notion of time dependent on motion.
So the Rambam doesn't have to really misrepresent Aristotle in order for him to. What the Rambam has to come out with,
mm-hmm.
what he has to face with is that even Lefi Aristotle, we can still show.
The Rambam is going to say that. He wants to show he refutes Aristotle. You see,
have to refute Aristotle.
He says he's going to refute him. There's an esoteric and exoteric message in the Rambam. The Rambam has to show the Chitzonius, I'm refuting Aristotle. Or I'm being Makel Sufek. Right? Really what I'm doing is, I'm explaining something in a way there's no machlokas. But that's for the person who really understands these things. But the person who doesn't understand these things has to think that he's refuting them. And it could possibly be, based upon this, this is the shot of the first paragraph. Why am I summarizing the opinions of the philosophers? Because you already have tremendous achievements. If you read Aristotle, you know what I'm doing. That's what I'm summarizing Aristotle. Why am I summarizing Aristotle? This is not Aristotle's argument. It's Pulfakir Aristotle's argument. But if you really understand what I'm doing in the Marna Vulcan, you're going to see that I'm explaining things as if I'm refuting Aristotle. But what I'm really doing is saying that what? The things have nothing to do with each other. The Rambam is speaking on two levels. I think that's what he's trying to do. I know it's a bit chiddush of the Rambam, but I think it's a pshat in the Rambam. If you look at the physics, I mean, I looked through this thing a few times, and I can't find and I mean, he never makes the proof like this. One thing. By the way, this is not the only time the Rambam does the Marna Vulchan. He does it several times. Even the proofs of God, they're based upon Aristotle's proof, but they're not the same thing as Aristotle's proof. They're different things.
But they're all the kinds of proofs which, at least from a physics point of view, Aristotle would have to agree that the things that the Rambam, the equations that the Rambam is basing himself upon in order to derive what he's deriving, agree with Aristotle's system.
You know, for sure. No, for sure. No, right. But
he ends up doing something which Aristotle would consider a big chutzpah.
Ah, right.
But,
otherwise,
but nonetheless, if I look at Aristotle's idea of first mover, first cause, I would be able to show from there that time is infinite.
I understand that, because that's an Aristotle's concept of time.
So it's pashut why the Rambam doesn't revert to the parenthetic.
But why does the Rambam have to go from motion to time? Aristotle went from time to motion.
No, that's to say, but you were saying earlier at the beginning with the muscle of Rashi and Tesis.
Yeah, right.
Right? So you were saying... I hope
I haven't offended Rashi, Rabbi Seder, and Shainu.
No, I'm saying it's more, it's simpler than that.
Yeah.
You don't have to misrepresent Aristotle in order to come out with the conclusions that the Rambam needs in order to make his argument.
I say, I don't want to misrepresent Aristotle. I would say, I may use the wrong language. What I'm saying is, he's giving the gist of Aristotle's
right,
argument.
Maybe he's emphasizing the
wrong... Right,
the wrong
it's, put it this way. When I say misrepresent, it's the Rambam's interpretation of Aristotle.
Shifting the focus of
Aristotle. Right.
But still, we can understand why he doesn't fall back on the parenthetic comment that he makes in an earlier chapter, because he wants to show that it's consonant with the main thrust of Aristotle's...
Fine. I mean, for sure he wants to be close to Aristotle as possible. But you see that the Rambam is making a big deal. I mean, he has a whole introduction here. You know, I know that you've achieved, you've learned philosophy, I don't know what's he saying that for? He didn't say that in other places. In his proofs of the different proofs of Aristotle of God, he didn't say that in other places. He says it over here. Why does he say it over here? I claim because this is you, the reader. Who's you, the reader? So, Pashtus, that's Yosef. But you, the reader, means the alerted, discerning, intelligent reader. That you should know that if you have Aristotle in front of you, you'll see what I'm doing. I want to claim that's what the Rambam is doing. Now, I want to make... what's interesting is there's a little further thing, the good here too. This, I mentioned before, this argument that Aristotle puts in parentheses, we have to check out what the parentheses are. This argument that Aristotle makes in parentheses.
The square ones or the...
In 420, no, they're actually curved parentheses.
So those are like a sino.
What?
Dominica's like a sino.
You have to look at the book and see. No. It's clear that the Rambam had that.
Yeah.
It's clear that the Rambam had that, because Rambam's, in chapter 15, speaks about our he quotes it. I don't know, maybe this was put in by one of the Islamic, whatever, I don't know. What I'm saying is that what's interesting is, I mentioned the fact that this argument here about time is being basically none exists in the present, there's only a past, only a future. But with time, the present is like the part of the past, the future. Is made by Kreskos. You should know something. Kreskos was a main opponent of Aristotle. Kreskes was the Jewish philosopher who created an entire physics and metaphysics which opposed Aristotle. Interesting enough, in other words, this argument about time is very, is, I mean, if you would ask Kreskes, he would tell you this is an anti-Aristotelian concept. He's giving an argument like this. He can't say this about motion, about time. So, in other words, it's a further proof of the Gaia, further proof that this argument is not a Aristotelian, you know what, the beginning with time, going to motion, right? But the argument about time, in other words, if I'm going to talk, if I assume time is part of motion is one thing, but the argument itself is not a very, Aristotle only assumes time in terms of motion. Kreskes utilized this in trying to actually understand creation ex nihilo. And in the upcoming book on the lectures of Rabbi Soloveitchik on Genesis, you will see this argument. I think there's an entire chapter devoted to Kreskes' understanding of creation ex nihilo. Anyway, how much longer do we have?
1 minute?
4 minutes. 4 minutes. Okay, anyway. I didn't get that far today, but we got so far. We got far. We actually saw that there's a little more depth in the Mor Nevuchim than we thought. I mean, not that we were chayshid, there wasn't depth in the Mor Nevuchim, but we've shown today that it's very worthwhile to have Aristotle in front of you when you read the Rambam, because especially when the Rambam says he's going to summarize that part of what we we're trying to understand the depth of the Rambam is really facilitated by comparing what the Rambam says about Aristotle, what Aristotle says himself. So with this, I think we'll sign off. This was the fifth class in the Mor Nevuchim.
Yes.
Okay, class level 5 has ended, and we will continue in the Rambam's refutation or dispelling of the proofs of Aristotle's theory of the eternity of the universe.